Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast. It's Monday, April 8th. We'll talk about the U.S. economy now and connect it to the presidential election year. The economy in most elections is issue number one, and in case you missed it, the jobs report for March came out on Friday and once again exceeded economists' expectations with a net gain of more than 303,000 jobs. So we have headlines like these from the AP. Another month of robust U.S. job growth points to continued economic strength. From Axios, the March jobs report was as good as it gets. Here's why. And the first reason that they gave is that unemployment has remained below 4% for 26 months. From NPR, construction hiring booms in overall strong jobs report. The lead line in the Wall Street Journal story was, the U.S. economy is rapidly adding jobs, but not in a very inflationary way. And from ABC, hinting at the political connection, blockbuster jobs report flexes economic strength, defying Americans' lukewarm attitudes. So those are some representative headlines from Friday. Of course, those lukewarm attitudes tend to be connected to inflation and interest rates. Even as people have jobs, get paid, and are spending quite a bit, according to stats from the government. So let's try to figure out what it all means economically and politically with Megan Casella, CNBC correspondent covering the intersection of Wall Street and Washington. She's also covering Treasury Secretary Yellen's trip to China, and we'll talk about that too. Megan, thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC Today.
Thanks so much for having me. Happy to be here.
Can you start with more about the jobs report? I saw expectations were for about 200,000 net new jobs in March, and it came in at more than 300,000. Where were the biggest surprises?
Yeah, there were a lot of surprises here. I mean, more than a 50% increase above what economists had expected. It's really good. I liked in that headline roundup the one that said this is as good as it gets, because I do think you could argue that for March, this is about as good as it gets. Huge number of people finding work, more people coming into the labor force, participation rate increasing. We saw, you know, some stalwart sectors hiring at government and healthcare that seemed to always need workers, but some cyclical ones were hiring as well, leisure and hospitality, for example, perhaps ramping up for a busy spring and summer season. So that was really across the board strength. And then at the same time, wages, perhaps a little bit surprisingly, were not increasing. They slowed just a little bit, down to about 4.1%. That's still a little bit high. Economists generally think something more in line with about a 3.5% increase year over year in wage growth is more consistent with the level they'd like to see to keep inflation steady. But they like the trend there. And it's a really good sign that we're able to add this many workers without seeing wages increase rapidly. It means that we're not overheating in a way that would be more concerning.
Tell us more about those cyclical sectors, as you call them. The Wall Street Journal also used the word stalwart. I guess that's a term you use in business reporting. The stalwart sectors, such as healthcare and government, kept adding jobs, but so did more cyclical sectors like construction, retail, trade, and what you mentioned, hospitality and leisure. NPR also focused on construction. Anything you can say about what the construction sector in particular expanding indicates, or some of those others that are cyclical?
Yeah, I think it's a good point. It's always interesting to focus on the different industries, to take a look at them. And what's interesting to me about the cyclical ones is these are the ones that tend to be a little bit more vulnerable to sort of economic whims. Is the economy slowing? Are people going out to dinner? Are they still going to sporting events? Are they still booking flights? So they tend to be a little bit more susceptible to changes in optimism or in just regular consumer spending. So it's important that those are still growing, because it means that nobody's scared yet of inflation or of any sort of looming recession the way everyone was worried about maybe 6 or 9 months ago. It really seems like people are willing to go out and have fun and spend money still. And then on construction in particular, this is such an interesting one. I spoke with an economist maybe a year ago now who argued that the missing recession, which of course is still missing, it was missing then, it's missing now, it's been long forecast and hasn't come yet. And this person argued that the lack of a construction slowdown was really the main piece that we never got. And an important thing to remember here is just how much the Biden administration has spent to stimulate the construction sector. They weren't doing it just to prop up construction. They were doing it because they want to ramp up our infrastructure, because they're trying to build chips factories and more semiconductor manufacturing in this country. But the effect, perhaps unintended or a beneficial side effect, is that we really continue to keep hiring in the construction sector. So the data shows us that is continuing to happen. And that means that that then feeds a lot of other industries, and manufacturing and other sorts of more blue collar jobs are continuing to benefit from that as well. So I would say you can pretty clearly see a link between the stimulus spending in some of these sectors and the fact that the economy is so, so strong today.
I want to talk about inflation a little bit more. Again, to cite that Wall Street Journal line, they said rapidly adding jobs, but not in a very inflationary way. And you just said something similar. And that sounds like really good news. Can you explain some of the basics of how new jobs could add to inflation? Just because people are employed, prices go up?
There's some of that. There's, you know, the longer that people are spending, if we're all competing for the same number of goods, then those prices could go up if there's nothing stopping consumer demand, right? But I think the clearer link here between jobs and inflation is wages are key. And that was why I highlighted that figure. So if you think about it, if employers are creating 303,000 new jobs in a month the way they were in March, that's a huge number. And like you said earlier, we're years into this expansion. So the thinking goes, how can we continue creating that many jobs per month if our population isn't growing at the same pace? It might mean that employers have to start competing for workers, and they're trying to lure workers away from jobs. They're offering raises and bonuses, and then employers might have to compete with each other, and we start to see wages rise because workers are in demand. What was really good about March is that we didn't see wages rise. And beneath the data, what you noticed is that the actual size of the labor pool expanded and labor force participation increased overall, and the prime age labor force participation rate, which is really for those 25 to 54 year olds, that is also higher than it was in February 2020, right before the pandemic hit. So that means more people are coming in off of the sidelines. Immigration is likely playing a big role here. That's one way. Our demographics aren't really helping us as a country. Our population is aging, our domestic population is aging. But if we can get more immigration back in, those folks help fill roles, help fill jobs, and then we don't have such intense competition for workers. It also, as more people are coming in off the sidelines, that might be because of flexible work arrangements. The Journal actually had a good piece on that, saying that this flexibility and more working from home means that more people can work who have been out of the labor force. Maybe that's stay-at-home parents or older workers or disabled workers. So the more that can happen to bring more people into the labor force, both from abroad and at home, means that employers then don't have to compete quite as hard. They can continue creating jobs and still have the workers to fill them.
Mm. And one more time from the Wall Street Journal story, they have this headline, "Strong Jobs Report Still Leaves Wiggle Room for the Fed, but not much." And that means even with not much inflationary pressure from the new jobs, as you've just been describing, it still has the Fed wary about future inflation, so they may not lower rates?
That's right. And it's also that it's harder to make an argument that they need to cut rates. We're going to see updated inflation numbers on Wednesday, and that'll be really key for determining the Fed's immediate path forward. But one thing, you know, that we always say, when are they cutting rates? When are they cutting rates? Some economists like to point out the counterfactual or just the opposing view of just why would they cut rates? If we're creating above trend job growth, above trend numbers of jobs each month, if we're not seeing wages spiraling higher, yes, they don't need to raise rates further. Obviously, they made that decision now many months ago. But there's not much that it says they need to cut them either. Consumers are spending, employers are hiring, markets are happy, everything looks pretty good. So why would you lower rates and maybe risk inviting premature inflation if you don't need to? That's the argument there.
We're talking about unemployment relatively low, but a few people are calling in on unemployment and underemployment. in various sectors. So let's take one of those. Stacy in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Stacy.
Hi. Actually, I'm in Manhattan. It's okay.
Okay, sorry.
I don't see these numbers. I am in my mid-50s. I'm a middle management. I've been out for 6 months. I know tons and hundreds of people who are in the same position as me. I wonder where these numbers are coming from. That's my point, is that sometimes I think these numbers are skewed. And, you know, and plus gig workers. I mean, I know a lot of people who are doing gig stuff now, and they're people with advanced degrees. So I just feel like we're not getting the whole story.
Stacy, if you're comfortable saying, you work in middle management in what sector of the economy?
I was working for marketing and advertising.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So, Megan?
Yeah, it's a really good point. And I completely empathize with everyone who's in a similar position, because we always know the data doesn't tell the full story. And this is actually really interesting. From a political point of view, this is one of the hardest things that Biden administration has been grappling with, is that on the one hand, the data is really strong. They're inclined to go out there and celebrate and say, look how well we're doing, particularly compared to where we thought we might be at this point when the pandemic first hit and was just wreaking economic havoc. But they also know that that doesn't resonate with so many people. And we're still seeing, though they've been improving, we're seeing pretty low consumer optimism numbers or consumer pessimism numbers in the sentiment data. And we are seeing people sometimes pick up multiple jobs or switch to gig work and that sort of thing. So I think, you know, different industries are not, some are not doing as well as others. Marketing and advertising sort of falls in the broader media world that has definitely seen some difficulties, as has the technology sector or the information sector, where we've seen some layoffs. By and large, the data is good in the aggregate, but I do think that that risks glossing over a lot of these hiccups in specific industries and specific geographic locations or whatever it might be, that really not everyone is on the same page, and that's worth remembering.
And a number of people are texting about wages and a disconnect perhaps between what should happen theoretically according to the economics textbooks, as you were describing before. If there's competition for labor, wages should go up. But listener writes, the number of jobs may be good, but what about the wages they pay? How many Americans can't afford housing, health care, even food? Another listener writes, could these numbers also be explained by a deflationary pressure on wages? Are the new jobs just not paying that much? Yet another listener writes, I worked in the event promotions and production industry. I noticed that within the last 2 years, the wages have been cut back to pre-COVID wages. Another one more. These are all from different listeners. These discussions need to disconnect the rise in corporate price power and their increased profits from greedflation. So are there wage statistics attached to the jobs numbers statistics that came out Friday?
There are. This is such an interesting snapshot of how people are feeling, because, again, this is where we're seeing a disconnect between the hard data and what people are saying and feeling. So wages were up, I believe it was 4.1% in the jobs data that just came out on Friday. That's slightly slower than the 4.3% the month prior. But year over year, wages are up in aggregate more than 4%. But what's hard, what's difficult is that when you break that down by income sector, some sectors are seeing their wage growth outpace inflation. I think most often you're seeing the lowest income sectors are actually doing well and just recently have begun to outpace inflation. But it's very rare for wages to go down, but it's also very rare for prices to go down. So if your wages are holding steady, if you haven't gotten a raise in a while, or even if they're increasing, you know, a cost of living 2.5-3%, that's below average right now. And that's also not going up as quickly as inflation has been. Even though inflation is way down from its peak, it's still up more than 3% year over year, month after month after month now. Over the last 2 years, it's up a huge amount that I don't have the number in front of me, but it's really up a lot. Somebody mentioned housing. Housing is up even higher. Some of these core areas of spending that you really just can't get away from are up stubbornly high. So I think that's part of what makes people feel a little bit pessimistic here, or maybe a lot pessimistic, is that they're being told, you know, they're seeing all these headlines of the economy is doing so great and they really don't feel it. And a huge part of that is just that the cost of living is going up faster than wages are.
Still a lot of unhappiness coming in on text message, in text messages. Listener writes, union laborer in publishing, I'm not feeling this great economy. My wages barely cover life in New York City. Another one, why is salad dressing $9 a bottle and Ben and Jerry's $10.49 and college tuition is spiking $90,000? Another listener writes, every month we hear that the figures are much better than economists expected. Who are these incompetent, pessimistic economists? What do you think about that one?
I think that's an interesting one. Actually, before I was covering economics as closely as I am, I always wondered, why do we only care about the consensus opinion? Why don't we care about the overall trend? And of course, we care about both. You know, these are generally economists from the major banks and investment firms and groups that all submit their own forecasts. And they take really close look at every single data release, even the ones you really aren't hearing about all that often. There's data coming out almost every day that gets factored into these forecasts. And then news organizations like Bloomberg or The Wall Street Journal or organization called FactSet will consolidate them all and take an average of all of those and then say, this is what was expected and this is how we did. I agree with you, though. It's interesting to always see the market, for example, react when something is way above or below expectations versus just how the overall trend looks. But I think both are taken into account. And it's hard. It's definitely hard to always reconcile what you're seeing in the data versus what you're hearing on the ground, as a lot of these comments are showing us.
And here's another interesting one. Wondering if the fact that the labor markets don't seem to be affected by the Fed's moves could support the opposite point. Why not cut rates if the Fed's rates don't seem to be working the way they were hoping to cool labor markets?
The worry there is really on the inflation side. It's about this premature reheating of the economy that if already in the data, if already it looks like people are really doing well, employers are doing well, wages are still rising more than they want, inflation is still rising faster than they would like to see, that there's no reason to cut rates because then we might see that take off even faster. You know, as an example, I have a mortgage payment and I just bought a house a couple months ago. So my mortgage rate is quite high. So if they were to cut, then everybody who has a mortgage at a high rate could refinance and have a lower rate and suddenly have that much more money on hand for consumer spending. Then we might book a vacation we might not otherwise have booked. So it really quickly, you might start to see spending increase above even where it is, and then we could see inflation start to pick back up again. That's what they're concerned about. And if the economy isn't starting to falter on its own, they figure maybe we have a little bit more room to keep rates high for a little bit longer.
A few more interesting texts. Somebody writes, I'm sick of hearing people complain about inflation. Consumer spending is off the rails. Another listener writes, as kind of pushback on this idea that a lot of immigration is good for the economy because it holds inflation down, because it holds wages down. Listener writes, if black unemployment runs roughly double that of whites, then the lower wages that immigrants cause is a greater threat to black workers. What do you think?
I think I would have to look closer at the data to know for sure. I do think that bringing black unemployment down would be a major beneficial step for the economy. It's something this administration has talked about, actually. And it's something that we saw early in the pandemic. First, there were thoughts that black unemployment would stay high. Then there was a lot of progress that was celebrated with it coming back down. But clearly, if we're looking for workers, like I mentioned, that's one of the reasons we need immigration, is because we need to find more workers. Then we, of course, need to look at the groups that are not participating as much in the economy or that have higher unemployment rates. And black workers tend to be at or near the top of that list. So I do think that's a little bit how it ties in with immigration, is as long as we see more of those workers start finding work, that's better for everybody in the economy.
In our last 2 minutes, I see you've also been writing about Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen's trip to China. What's she doing in China?
She has just wrapped up her trip. Yellen was there for about 5 days, and she was there to meet with her economic counterparts and to meet with business leaders operating in China. And she really, you know, the administration said, don't expect any major policy developments out of this trip. But the goal was to continue managing the economic relationship. She ended up focusing a lot on trade while she was there. She really brought this pretty firm message about industrial overcapacity. It's this idea that the Chinese government has been very heavily subsidizing certain manufacturing industries, particularly what Yellen called green technologies, EVs and solar cells. And what she's worried about is that with so much government investment, they're producing too much. They're going to flood the global market with really cheap imports, and that hurts manufacturers in the U.S. and around the globe. So she really brought a firm message there. She says it was well received, that she got some pledges from China to perhaps start to curb their behavior. So it was all about mostly trade and managing that relationship with our fellow largest economy.
Trump is running on imposing tariffs on goods from China. In fact, I think all imports, as a way to keep American manufacturing jobs being created, and as a way to keep wages high, because those American manufacturers wouldn't have to compete with cheap imports. Does Biden have a response to that?
Biden has taken, what's interesting to me, I covered trade for the entirety of the Trump administration. And while Biden has taken a much calmer and more measured approach to China, on the policy minutia, he actually really hasn't changed very much. He left Trump's initial round of tariffs on China in place. Those are still there. And Yellen this week was talking about potentially, she said, her wording was that she wouldn't rule out anything to protect our domestic manufacturing industries, and that includes tariffs. So the Biden administration would not do anything close to what Trump is proposing, which is 60% tariffs on all goods imported from China. But they do want, they're not afraid to use tariffs. They've kept some in place, and they're considering more. One note on tariffs I will add, though, is that despite now bipartisan support for tariffs, most economists continue to say that tariffs are a tax on consumers. If we're buying something from China and there's an import tax on it or a tariff on it, then that means the consumer pays more rather than anyone else. So despite bipartisan support, there's still economic pushback there.
Right, which suggests a larger discussion that we'll have to have another day, which is, would we rather have a high price, high wage economy, or a cheap goods, low wage economy, which is actually better for the average American? But we leave that there unanswered with Megan Casella, who covers Washington for the Business Channel, CNBC. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.